For my whole 16 years, I've rarely thought I was worth much more than a distracted grumble from God. But now, in my shelter of all things impossible, I drift in a warm bath of forgiveness, and it seems pointless to resist. I have no energy for improving myself. If Anatole can wrap all my rattlebone sins in a blanket and call me goodness itself, why then, I'll just believe him. That is all I can offer by way of explaining our surprising courtship. As I wake up out of my months-long sleep, I find the course of my life has narrowed right down, and I feel myself rushing along it like a flood of rich red mud. I believe I'm very happy. I can't say how many weeks we were here before Mother left, or how many have passed since. I've had the good fortune of shelter. This hut belongs to a pupil of Anatole's whose father lived here but is now deceased. Anatole left Kilanga soon after we did, and now spends a lot of time in neighboring villages talking to people and organizing something large. He seems to have countless friends and resources in Bulungu, and I can stay here as long as I need to. But Mother couldn't. Mother could hardly sit still. The day she left stands out in my mind as a drenched sunny morning. The rain was letting up, and Anatole thought I was well enough to leave my mosquito tent for a few hours. We would go as far as the Kuenge to say goodbye. Rachel had already flown away with her devil savior, and I was nailed down in Bulungu since my body was still sunk so deep in poison it couldn't bear up to many more mosquito bites. But Mother and Ada were leaving. A commissant had arrived by truck from Leopoldville, and in the rainy season that was a miracle not to be snubbed. He intended to return to the city with a cargo of bananas and shook his stick fiercely at the Congolese women who tried to clamber onto his massively loaded truck for a ride. But perhaps, the commissant decided, looking Mother up and down, avoiding her rigid blue gaze, perhaps he had room for the white woman. In the great green mountain of bananas he fixed a nest just big enough for Mother and one of her children. I thought Ada's lameness and Mother's desperation had purchased his sympathy. I didn't know until later there were rumors of huge rewards for white women delivered safely to the embassy in Leopoldville. The truck was orange. I do remember that. Anatole and I rode along as far as the river to see them off. I vaguely heard Anatole making promises to Mother on my behalf. He would get me well, he'd send me when I felt ready to go home. It seemed he was speaking of someone else as surely as the man with horns had flown away with someone other than Rachel. As we all bobbed precariously on the mountain of bananas, I just stared at Mother and Ada, trying to memorize what remained of my family. As soon as we arrived at the mucky bank of the Kuenge, we spotted a problem. The old flatbed ferry boat had been functional just the day before, the commissant claimed, but now it bobbed listlessly on the opposite shore in spite of his piercing whistles and waving arms. Two fishermen turned up in a dugout canoe and informed us the ferry was stranded with no power. This was normal, it seemed. Not insurmountable, at any rate. Up came our truck's hood and out came the battery, which the fishermen would carry across the Kuenge to the ferry. For a price, of course. The commissant paid it, muttering curses that seemed too strong for the early hour, since this was surely only the first irritation of a very long trip, or the third if you counted my mother and Ada as the first two. It was explained to us that the ferryman would jerry-rig the battery to start his ferry's engine and come back across to us. Then we could push the truck onto the ferry and reunite it with its battery again on the other side. Right away, though, another problem. The immense truck battery was of an ancient type too large to be wedged down in the belly of the tiny canoe. After great discussion, the fishermen found an answer. A pair of broad planks were set across the boat in a peculiar configuration that required the battery to ride on one side with a counterweight on the other. There being no large rocks at hand, the fishermen eyed Ada and me. They decided either one of us would work for ballast, but feared Ada's handicap would prevent her holding on, and if she fell in the river, the precious battery would also be lost. Mother, looking straight ahead, agreed I was the stronger one. No one mentioned I was dizzy with malaria fever, nor did it occur to me to raise this as an excuse. Anatole held his tongue in deference to my family. We'd lost so much already. Who was he to tell us how to risk what was left? I went in that canoe. I could tell the river was receding from its rainy season flood by its peculiar rank smell and all the driftwood stranded along its banks. I marveled that I'd learned so much about Congolese rivers. I thought of my mother's lifelong warning to us children whenever we entered a boat, if it overturns, grab hold for dear life. Yet Congolese pirogues are made of such dense wood, if they capsize, they sink like a rock. All these thoughts passed through me while the fishermen paddled urgently across the swift, boiling Kuenge. I clung to the rough plank poised far out over the water, giving all my might to the service of balance. I don't remember letting out my breath until we were safely across. Possibly I've imagined this. The whole episode seems impossibly strange. I mentioned it later, and Anatole laughed at what he called my reconstructed history. He claims I rowed inside the canoe at my own request because the weight of the oddly shaped battery tipped the boat dangerously. Yet the event keeps returning to me in my dreams exactly as I've described it, with all the same sights and smells occurring in sequence as I stretched my weight over the water. It's hard for me to doubt this is how it happened. I can't deny my brain was still muddled, though. I have only the haziest recollection of waving at my mother and sister in a rising cloud of diesel exhaust and mosquitoes as they began their slow, permanent exodus from the Congo. I wish I could remember their faces, Ada's especially. Did she feel I'd helped to save her? Or was it just more of the same parceling out of fortunes that had brought us this far, to this place where our path would finally divide into two? I've compensated by remembering everything about Anatole in the days that followed. The exact green taste of the concoctions he boiled to cure me, the temperature of his hand on my cheek, the stitched patterns of light through thatch when morning entered the darkness where we slept, I against one wall, he against the other. We shared the fellowship of orphans. I felt it acutely, like a deep hunger for protein, and despaired for the flat dirt expanse between Anatole and me. I begged him closer, inch by inch, clinging to his hands when he brought the cup. Now the bitterness of quinine and sweetness of kissing are two tastes perfectly linked on my soft palate. I had never loved a man before, physically, and I've read enough of both Jane Eyre and Brenda Starr to know every first love is potent. But when I fell into mine, I was drugged with the exotic delirium of malaria, so mine is omnipotent. How can I ever love anyone now but Anatole? Who else could make the colors of the aurora borealis rise off my skin where he strokes my forearm, or send needles of ice tinkling blue through my brain when he looks in my eyes? What else but this fever could commute my father's ghost crying Jezebel into a curl of blue smoke drifting out through a small bright hole in the thatch? Anatole banished the honey-colored ache of malaria and guilt from my blood. By Anatole I was shattered and assembled. By way of Anatole, I am delivered not out of my life, but through it. Love changes everything. I never suspected it would be so. Requited love, I should say, for I've loved my father fiercely my whole life, and it changed nothing. But now, all around me, the flame trees have roused from their long dry sleep into walls of scarlet blossom. Anatole moves through the dappled shade at the edges of my vision, wearing the silky pelt of a panther. I crave to feel that pelt against my neck. I crave it with a predator's impatience, ignoring time, keening to the silence of owls. When he's gone away for a night or two, my thirst is inconsolable. When he comes back, I drink every kiss down to its end, and still my mouth aches like a dry cave. Anatole didn't take me. I chose him. Once long ago, he forbade me to say out loud that I loved him, so I'll invent my own ways to tell him what I long for and what I can give. I grip his hands and don't let go. And he stays, cultivating me like a small inheritance of land where his future resides. Now we sleep together under the same mosquito net, chastely. I don't mind saying I want more, but Anatole laughs and rubs his knuckles into my hair, pushes me playfully out of the bed, tells me to go get my bow and hunt a bushbuck if I want to kill something. The word bandika, for kill with an arrow, has two meanings, you see. He said it wasn't the time for me to become his wife, in the sense used by the Congolese. I was still mourning, he said, still sick, still living partly in another place. Anatole is a patient farmer. He reminds me that our arrangement is not at all unusual. He's known many men to take even 10-year-olds as brides. At 16, I am worldly by some people's standards, and by anyone's, I'm devoted. The fever in my bones has subsided, and the air no longer dances with flames, but Anatole still comes to me at night in the pelt of a panther. I'm well enough to travel now. It's been true for a while, really, but it was easy for me to stay on here with Anatole's friends in Bulungu, and hard for us to speak of what comes next. Finally, this evening, he had to ask. He took my hand as we walked to the river, which surprised me, as he's normally reticent to show affection in public. I suppose it wasn't very public. The only people we could see were the fishermen mending their nets on the opposite shore. We stood watching them while the sunset painted the river with broad streaks of pink and orange. Islands of water hyacinths floated past in the drowsy current. I was thinking I'd never felt more content or known such beauty in my whole life. And right then he said, "Beane, you're well. You can go, you know. I promised your mother I would see that you got safely home." My heart stopped. Where does she think home is? Where you are happiest. Where do you want me to go? Where you will be happy, he said again. And so I told him where that place is. Nothing could be easier. I thought about it long and hard and decided that if he will tolerate me as I am, I'll decline to return to all familiar comforts in order to stay here. It was an unusual proposal by the standards of any culture. We stood on the bank of the Quingay, listing the things we'll have to abandon or relinquish. It's important information. For all I may be forsaking, he's giving up a good deal more. The possibility of having more wives than one, for instance. And that's only the beginning. Even now, I think Anatole's friends doubt his sanity. My whiteness could bar him outright from many possibilities, maybe even survival, in the Congo. But Anatole had no choice. I took him and held on. There's enough of my father in me that I had to stand my ground. Rachel Price Axelrout, Johannesburg, South Africa, 1962. Want so lief het Gott die Welt gehad, dat hij sie enig bora soon gege het, so dat elkeen wat in hom glo, ni verlore mag gan nie, mar die ewige lewa kan he. How do you like that, huh? That's John 3:16 in Afrikaans. For the last entire year, I have worn my little white gloves and pillbox hat to the First Episcopal Church in Johannesburg and recited it right along with the best of them. And now one of my very close friends happens to be from Paris, France, and has taken me under her wing so I can also go to the Catholic service with her and recite, Car Dieu a tant aimé le monde qu'il a donné son fils unique. In French, in other words. I'm fluent in three languages. I have not remained especially close with my sisters, but I dare say that for all their being gifted and whatnot, they can't do a whole lot better than John 3:16 in three entire languages. Maybe that won't necessarily guarantee me a front row seat in heaven, but considering what all I've had to put up with from Eben Axelrout for the last year, just for starters, that ought to at least get me in the door. His gawking at other women when I'm still so young and attractive myself, and with my nerves shot already, I might add, since I've been through so much. Not to mention his leaving me alone while he goes on all his trips, getting rich on one crackpot scheme after another that never did pan out. I put up with him out of gratitude, mainly. I guess trading away your prime of life is a fair price for somebody flying you out of that hell hole. He did save my life. I promised him I would testify to those very words, rescued from imminent prospect of death. And I did, too, in a whole slew of forms so we could collect the money from the U.S. Embassy. They had emergency money available to help their citizens in reaching safety after the communist crisis with Lumumba and all that hubbub. Axelrout even got himself a little Medal of Honor for heroic service, which he is very vain of and keeps in a special box in the bedroom. For that reason, we couldn't actually get legally married right away. The way he explained it was, it wouldn't look right for him to collect money on saving his own wife. That kind of thing you would just naturally be expected to do on your own without getting paid for it or winning any medals of honor. Well, dumb me, I believed him. But it turns out Axelrout could collect medals galore in the Department of Avoiding Holy Matrimony. He has 101 reasons not to marry the cow so he can buy the milk for free. But I didn't think about that at the time, of course. Just imagine how it must have been for an impressionable young girl. There I was, shivering in the rain, surrounded on every side by mud huts, mud roads, mud everything. People squatting in the mud, trying to cook over a fire in the pouring rain. Dogs going crazy, running through the mud. We walked practically halfway across the Congo. That was my chosen path to suffering, as our dear old dad would have put it, not that I had any choice. I got baptized by mud. I laid me down at night on filthy floors and prayed the Lord I wouldn't wake up dead from a snake bite, as I had just seen happen tragically to my own sister, knowing full well it could just as soon have been me. Words cannot describe my mental framework. When we finally got to that village and there was Mr. Axelrout in his sunglasses leaning against his airplane, all smirking and sanforized in his broad-shouldered khaki uniform, I only had one thing to say. Enough already. Get me out of here. I didn't care what kind of forms I had to sign. I would have signed a deal with the devil himself. I swear I would have. So that's how it was for me. One day standing there up to my split ends in mud, and the next day strolling down the wide, sunny streets of Johannesburg, South Africa, among houses with nice green lawns and swimming pools and gobs of pretty flowers growing behind their lovely high walls with electric gates. Cars, even. Telephones. White people just everywhere you looked. At that time, Axelrod was just in the process of getting set up in Johannesburg. He has a brand new position in the security division of the gold mining industry near the northern suburbs where supposedly we are soon to be living in high style. Although after an entire year, all his promises are starting to show the telltale signs of age, not to mention our furniture, which every stick of it has all been previously owned. When I first got to Johannesburg, I stayed for a brief time with a very nice American couple, the Templetons. Miss Templeton had separate African maids for her cooking, cleaning, and laundry. I must have washed my hair 50 times in 10 days and used a clean towel each and every time. Oh, I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. Just to be back with people who spoke the good old American language and understood the principle of a flush toilet. Evens in my house is not nearly so grand, of course, but we certainly get by, and I supply the woman's touch. Axelrod did pretty well for himself as a pilot in the Congo, transporting perishable goods from the bush into the cities for retail sale, and he was also active in the diamond trade. He worked for the government, too, with his secret assignments and all, but he's never talked about it all that much since we started living together. Now that we have relations any old time we feel like it, which, by the way, I don't think is the worst sin there is when people's getting hurt, cheated, or killed left and right in this world, well, now Mr. Axelrod doesn't have to show off his big secrets to the princess to get a kiss out of her. So now his number one secret is, I need another beer, which just goes to show you. But I was determined right off the bat to make the best of my situation here in my new home of Johannesburg, South Africa. I just started going by the name Rachel Axelrod, and no one had to be the wiser, really. I've always made sure I go to church with the very best people, and we get invited to their parties. I insist on that. I have even learned to play bridge. It is my girlfriends here in Joburg that have taught me how to give parties, keep a close eye on the help, and just overall make the graceful transition to wifehood and adulteration. My girlfriends plus my subscription to the Ladies' Home Journal. Our magazines always arrive so late that we are 1 or 2 months out of style. We probably started painting our nails immoral coral after everybody sensible had already gone on to pink, but heck, at least we're all behind the times together. And the girls I associate with are very sophisticated in ways that you simply can't learn from a magazine, especially Robine, who is Catholic and from Paris, France, and will positively not eat dessert with the same fork she used at dinner. Her husband is the attaché to the ambassador, so talk about good manners. Whenever we're invited to the better homes for dinner, I just keep my eye on Robine, because then you can't go wrong. We girls stick together like birds of a feather, and thank goodness for that, because the men are always off on one kind of business or another. In Axelrod's case, as I've mentioned, it frequently turns out to be monkey business. For all I know, he's off somewhere saving some other damsel in distress with the promise of marriage someday after he's collected his reward money. That would be Axelrod all over, to turn up with an extra wife or two claiming that's how they do it here. Maybe he's been in Africa so long he's forgotten that we Christians have our own system of marriage, and it's called monotony. Well, I put up with him anyway. When I get out of bed every morning, at least I'm still alive and not dead like Ruth May. So I must have done something right. Sometimes you just have to save your neck and work out the details later. Like that little book said, stick out your elbows, pick up your feet, and float along with the crowd. The last thing you want to do is get trampled to death. As far as the actual day he flew me out of the Congo in his plane, it's hard for me even to remember what I thought was going to happen next. I was so excited to be getting out of that horrid mud hole I couldn't think straight. I'm sure I said goodbye to Mother and Ada and Leah, though I really don't remember giving a second thought to when I'd ever see them again, if ever. I must have been in an absolute daze. It's funny, but I do recall just this one thing. Eben's plane was hundreds of feet up in the air already, way over the clouds, when I suddenly remembered my hope chest. All those pretty things I'd made, monogrammed towels, a tablecloth, and matching napkins. It just didn't seem right to be getting married without them. As befuddled as I was, I made him promise he'd go back someday and get those things from our house in Kalanga. Of course he hasn't. I realize now it was just plain foolish of me to think he ever would. I guess you might say my hopes never got off the ground. Ada Price. Emory University, Atlanta, 1962. Tell all the truth, but tell it slant, says my friend Emily Dickinson. And really, what choice do I have? I am a crooked little person, obsessed with balance. I have decided to speak, so there is the possibility of telling. Speaking became a matter of self-defense since Mother seems to have gone mute, and with no one to testify to my place in the world, I found myself at the same precipice I teetered upon when entering the first grade, gifted or special education with the ear-pulling Crawleys. Not that I would have minded the company of simple minds, but I needed to flee from Bethlehem where the walls are made of eyes stacked in rows like bricks, and every breath of air has the sour taste of someone's recent gossip. We arrived home to a very special hero's welcome. The town had been starving outright for good scuttlebutt. So hip hip hooray, welcome home, the pitiful Prices. The astonishing, the bereft, bizarre, and homeless, for we could no longer live in a parsonage without a parson, tainted by darkest Africa and probably heathen, Orleana and Ada, who have slunk back to town without their man, like a pair of rabid Dalmatians staggering home without their fire engine. We were presumed insane. Mother took the diagnosis well. She moved our things out of storage into a plywood cabin on the piney outskirts of town, which she rented on the strength of a tiny legacy from Grandfather Wharton. She did not hook up the telephone. She took up a hoe instead and began to put every square inch of her sandy 2-acre rented lot under cultivation. Peanuts, sweet potatoes, and 4 dozen kinds of flowers. She seemed determined to grow tragedy out of herself like a bad haircut. A neighbor down the road had a mean goose and hogs whose manure Mother toted home daily like a good African in 2 balanced bushel pails. It would not have surprised me to see her put a 3rd bucket on her head. By midsummer, we could not see out the windows for the foxglove and the bachelor's buttons. Mother said she aimed to set up a plank shack by the road and sell bouquets for $3.50 apiece. I wondered what Bethlehem would say about that. The minister's wife gone barefoot to roadside commerce. As earnestly as Mother had taken up seed catalogs, I took up the catalog of Emory University and studied my possibilities. Then I rode the Greyhound to Atlanta and limped into the admissions office. I was allowed to have an interview with a gentleman named Dr. Holden Remile, whose job, I think, was to discourage people such as myself from asking for interviews with people such as himself. His desk was immense. I opened my mouth and waited for the sentence I hoped would arrive. I need to go to your college here, sir, and when I'm done with it, I will need to go to your medical school. Dr. Remile was quite shocked, whether by my deformity or my audacity, I can't say, but probably less shocked than I was by the sound of my own voice. He asked whether I had funds, whether I had high school transcripts, whether I had at least taken high school chemistry or advanced algebra. The only answer I had was, no, sir. But I did mention I had read quite a few books. Do you know what calculus is, young lady? He asked, in the manner of a person who is hiding something frightening in one of his hands. Having grown up around the hands of Reverend Price, I am fairly immune to such fright. Yes, sir, I said. It is the mathematics of change. His telephone rang. While I waited for him to have his conversation, I worked out in my head both the sum and the product of the numbers on the large numbered set of files on his bookshelf, which were all out of order, and made up an equation for writing them, which I wrote down for him on paper. I had to use algebra, though, not calculus. I also observed that his name backward was the French verb for wearing one's clothes threadbare, so I told him that as well, with no offense intended, as his clothes were fine. Dr. Remile suddenly ascertained that I was due some government benefits, being the child of a veteran. He set me up for taking the entrance examinations, for which I returned to Atlanta 1 month later. I didn't miss any of the questions in mathematics. On the verbal portion, I missed 4 questions, all having to do with choosing a word in a series that doesn't belong. I have always had trouble with that line of questioning. Given my own circumstances, I find that anything can turn out to belong nearly anywhere. I had told the truth. I needed to go to his college. I needed to get out of Bethlehem, out of my skin, my skull, and the ghost of my family. It is not because I was ashamed of Mother. How could I, the village idiot, be ashamed of her? I somewhat enjoyed the company of her madness, and certainly I understood it. But Mother wanted to consume me like food. I needed my own room. I needed books. And for the first time in my life, I needed schoolmasters who would tell me each day what to think about. In organic chemistry, invertebrate zoology, and the inspired symmetry of Mendelian genetics, I have found a religion that serves. I recite the periodic table of elements like a prayer. I take my examinations as Holy Communion, and the pass of the first semester was a sacrament. My mind is crowded with a forest of facts. Between the trees lie wide-open plains of despair. I skirt around them. I stick to the woods. Since I can't call her, I take the bus back on weekends. We drink tea, and she shows me her flowers. The odd thing is, when Father was around, she never gardened at all. That was his domain, and he directed us all in the planting of useful foods, all to the glory of God, and so forth. We never had one flower in our yard the whole of my childhood, not so much as a dandelion. Now Mother's shack is the mere peak of a roof surrounded by a blaze of pinks, blues, oranges. You have to bend under a wild arch of cosmos when you come up the walk and use your whole right arm to push the hollyhocks aside to get in the front door. It turns out Mother has an extraordinary talent for flowers. She was an entire botanical garden waiting to happen. When I visit her, we never talk much and are both relieved by the silence, I think. There are only the two of us now, and I owe her my very life. She owes me nothing at all. Yet I have left her, and now she is sad. I'm not used to this. I have always been the one who sacrificed life and limb and half a brain to save the other half. My habit is to drag myself imperiously through a world that owes me unpayable debts. I have long relied on the comforts of martyrdom. Now I owe a debt I cannot repay. She took hold of me with a fierce grip and pulled me through. Mother was going to drag me out of Africa if it was her last living act, and it very nearly was. This is how it happened. The commerçant, whose truck showed up like a rusted-out angel in Bulungu, promised us a ride to Leopoldville with his bananas. But he soon changed his mind and dumped us for more bananas. After a conference with some soldiers along the road, he became convinced that fruit was now bringing a higher price than white women in the city, so out we went. We walked for 2 days without food. At night, we crouched at the edge of the woods and covered ourselves with palm leaves so the soldiers wouldn't spot us. Late on the second evening, an army truck pulled up beside us, and a man threw us suddenly into the back where we landed across laps, helmets, rifles. No doubt the soldiers planned to do us harm. I was numb with that expectation. But Mother's milk-glass eyes frightened them. Plainly, she was possessed of some fierce evil that would enter these men if they touched her or me, especially me. So they kept their distance from both of us. We bumped along silently in the back of the truck, passing through dozens of military roadblocks, and were turned over to the Belgian embassy, which took us in until someone could sort out what ought to be done with us. We spent 19 days in the infirmary, swallowing a variety of specialized poisons, since we had intestinal parasites, fungus growing on our feet and forearms, and more than the usual degree of malaria. Then, on a hospital plane full of UN workers and sick white people, we were transported through a long, thrumming darkness in which we slept the sleep of the dead. When the droning stopped, we all sat up and blinked like disturbed corpses. There was light at the round windows. The belly of the plane groaned open, and we were delivered abruptly into the benign spring air of Fort Benning, Georgia. It is impossible to describe the shock of return. I recall that I stood for the longest time staring at a neatly painted yellow line on a neatly formed cement curb. Yellow, yellow, line, line. I pondered the human industry, the paint, the cement truck in concrete forms, all the resources that had gone into that one curb. For what? I could not quite think of the answer. So that no car would park there? Are there so many cars that America must be divided into places with and places without them? Was it always so, or did they multiply vastly along with telephones and new shoes and transistor radios and cellophane-wrapped tomatoes in our absence? Then I stared for a while at a traffic light, which was suspended elaborately on wires above the intersection. I couldn't look at the cars themselves. My brain was roaring from all the color and orchestrated metal movement. From the open building behind me came a blast of neutral-smelling air and a high hum of fluorescent lights. Even though I was outdoors, I felt a peculiar confinement. One discarded magazine lay on the edge of the street, impossibly clean and unblemished. A breeze gently turned the pages for me, one at a time. Here was a neatly coiffed white mother beside a huge white clothes dryer, and a fat white child, and a great mound of bright clean clothes that would be sufficient, it seemed to me, to clothe the whole village. Here were a man and woman holding between them a Confederate flag on a vast lawn so flat and neatly trimmed their shadows stretched behind them for the length of a fallen tree. Here was a blonde woman in a black dress and pearls and long red fingernails leaning over a blank white tablecloth toward a glass of wine. Here was a child in many kinds of new clothes hugging a doll so clean and unrumpled it seemed not to belong to her. Here was a woman in a coat and hat hugging a bundle of Argyle socks. The world seemed crowded and empty at the same time, devoid of smells and extremely bright. I continued to stare at the traffic light, which glowed red. Suddenly, a green arrow popped on, pointing left, and the row of cars, like obedient animals, all went left. I laughed out loud. Mother, meanwhile, had moved on. She was walking in a trance toward a pay telephone. I hurried and caught up with her a little timidly because she had cut straight to the front of a long line of soldier boys waiting to call home. She demanded that someone give us the correct change to call Mississippi, which two boys did in such a hurry you would think Mother was their commanding officer. The unfamiliar American coins felt light in my hands. I passed them to Mother, and she dialed some second cousins who promised to come collect us almost immediately, even though Mother had not spoken with them in nearly a decade. She still knew the telephone number by heart. Tell all the truth, but tell it slant. What secret is left in our family to tell? I may have to stop talking again until I can be sure of what I know. I thought I had it settled long ago, you see. My hymn to God, Evol's dog, dog ho. My hymn for love, Eros, Isor. Oh, I knew it all, backward and forward. I learned the balance of power in one long Congolese night when the driver ants came. The bang on the door, the dark hustle and burning feet, and last of all, Ada, dragging the permanent sing-song of her body, left, behind. Out into the moonlight where the ground boiled, and there stood Mother like a tree rooted motionless in the middle of a storm. Mother, staring at me, holding Ruth May in her arms, weighing the two of us against one another. The sweet, intact child with golden ringlets and perfectly paired strong legs, or the dark, mute adolescent dragging a stubborn, disjunct half-body. Which? After hesitating only a second, she chose to save perfection and leave the damaged. Everyone must choose. Live was I, ere I saw evil, I wrote in my journal. Alive one moment, dead the next, because that is how my divided brain divined the world. There was room in Ada for naught but pure love and pure hate. Such a life is satisfying and deeply uncomplicated. Since then, my life has become much more difficult, because later on, she chose me. In the end, she could only carry one child alive out of Africa, and I was that child. Would she rather have had Ruth May? Was I the booby prize? Does she look at me and despise her loss? Am I alive only because Ruth May is dead? What truth can I possibly tell? Recently, I rifled through the history of our father, an old trunk full of his things. I needed to find his military discharge papers, which would provide for me some benefits in the domain of college tuition. I found more than I was looking for. His medal is not, as we were always told, for heroic service. It is simply for having been wounded and having survived, for escaping from a jungle where all others marched to their deaths. No more than that. The conditions of his discharge were technically honorable, but unofficially they were cowardice, guilt, and disgrace. The Reverend, the sole survivor in a company of dead men who have marched along beside him all his life since then. No wonder he could not flee from the same jungle twice. Mother told me a part of the story, and I realized I already knew the rest. Fate sentenced our father to pay for those lives with the remainder of his, and he has spent it posturing desperately beneath the eyes of a God who will not forgive a debt. This God worries me. Lately he has been looking in on me. My sleep is visited by Ruth May and the many other children who are buried near her. They cry out, Mother, may I? And the mothers crawl forward on hands and knees, trying to eat the dirt from their babies' fresh graves. The owls still croon and croon, and the air is thick with spirits. This is what I carried out of the Congo on my crooked little back. In our 17 months in Kilanga, 31 children died, including Ruth May. Why not Ada? I can think of no answer that exonerates me. Mother's reasons for saving me were as complicated as fate itself, I suppose. Among other things, her alternatives were limited. Once she betrayed me, once she saved me. Fate did the same to Ruth May in the opposite order. Every betrayal contains a perfect moment, a coin stamped heads or tails with salvation on the other side. Betrayal is a friend I have known a long time, a two-faced goddess looking forward and back with a clear, earnest suspicion of good fortune. I have always felt I would make a clear-eyed scientist on account of it. As it turns out, though, betrayal can also breed penitents, shrewd minor politicians, and ghosts. Our family seems to have produced one of each. Carry us, marry us, Pharius, Barius, those are our four ways to Exodus, for now. Though to tell the truth, none of us has yet safely made the crossing. Except for Ruth May, of course. We must wait to hear word from her. I rode on the ferry. Until that morning, when we all went to the riverbank, I still believed Mother would take Leah, not me. Leah, who, even in her malarial stupor, rushed forward to crouch with the battery in the canoe and counter its odd tilt. I was outshone, as usual, by her heroism. But as we watched that pirogue drift away across the Quengue, Mother gripped my hand so tightly I understood I had been chosen. She would drag me out of Africa if it was her last living act as a mother. I think probably it was. Leah Price, Mission Notre-Dame de Douleur, 1964. La Dragueuse, the nuns call me here. The minesweeper. And not because my habit drags the ground, either. I wear trousers underneath and tuck it up half the time just to move faster or climb up a tree with my bow to shoot a little meat, which I'd say they're happy to have. But I can see in their eyes they think I have too much piss and vinegar for the present circumstances. Even Sir Therese, who's the closest thing I have to a friend here in the Grand Silence, has marked me as the black sheep in this snowy flock by insisting I wear all brown below the shoulders. She's in charge of the hospital laundry and claims I'm a hopeless case where white is concerned. Liselin, she scolds, holding up my scapular stained with the blood of something or other, some cat I have skinned. The monthly visit, I'll offer, and she doubles over pink-faced, declaring me détro. Yet I look around me and wonder how, in the present circumstances, any amount of piss and vinegar could possibly be enough. Liselin is me, Sir Liselin, a mercy case smuggled in under cover of darkness, given refuge for the indefinite term of my fiancé's imprisonment, tucked for the meantime into too much cloth and married to the Lord to conceal my maiden name. I hope he understands when I pray that our marriage won't last forever. The sisters seem to forget I'm not one of them, even though they know how I came here. Therese makes me repeat the details while her gray eyes grow wide. Here she is, merely 20 years old and thousands of miles from the pastures of France, washing out the dressings of lepers and awful miscarriages, yet she's electrified by my narrow escape. Or maybe that I shared it with Anatole. When we're alone in the sweltering laundry room, she asks me how I know I'm in love. I must be. What else would make you stupid enough to put hundreds of people in danger? It's true. I did that. When I finally woke up from my drugged stupor in Bulungu, I could see what a burden I'd been, not just for the fufu and fish sauce I'd eaten day after day, but for being a foreigner in the eye of a storm. Mobutu's army was known to be ruthless and unpredictable. Bulungu could be accused of anything for harboring me. Bulungu could also be burned to the ground for no reason at all. Everyone learned fast the best strategy was to be invisible. Yet my presence was known throughout the region. I was a gaudy flag waving overhead during all those months of sickness and oblivion, just a girl in love, the center of my own universe. Finally, I sat up to see the sun still rose in the east, but everything else had changed. I begged Anatole to get me out to any place where I wouldn't be a danger to others, but he wouldn't send me alone. He insisted I had nothing to be ashamed of. He was risking his own pro-Lumumbist neck to stay near me, but many people were now taking risks for what they loved, he said, or simply for what they knew. Soon we'd go, he promised, and go together. Plans were laid for us by friends, including some men from Kilanga I'd never dreamed would take such chances for Anatole. Tata Bwanda, for one. Bright red trousers and all, he arrived late one night on foot, toting a suitcase on his head. He had money for us that he claimed was owed to my father, though this is doubtful. The suitcase was ours. In it were a dress and a coloring notebook of Ruth May's, pieces of our hope chests, my bow and arrows. Someone in Kilanga saved these precious things for us. I suppose it's also possible the women who went through our house didn't want these items, though the bow at least would have been valuable. A third possibility, then. Dismayed by the failure of our Jesus to protect us, they opted to steer clear. The news of Father wasn't good. He was living alone. I hadn't thought of this. Who would cook for him? I'd never envisioned Father without women's keeping. Now he was reported to be bearded, wild-haired, and struggling badly with malnutrition and parasites. Our house had burned, with the blame going either to Mother's spirit or the mischief of village children, though Tata Bwanda allowed it was probably Father trying to toast meat over a kerosene flame. Father ran off to a hut in the woods he was calling the New Church of Eternal Life, Jesus is Bungalow. As promising as that sounds, he wasn't getting a lot of takers. People were waiting to see how well Jesus protected Tata Price now that he had to get by the same as everyone without outside help from the airplane or even women. So far, Father seemed to be reaping no special advantages. Additionally, his church was too close to the cemetery. Tata Bwanda told me with sincere kindness that Ruth May was mourned in Kilanga. Tata Ndu threatened to exile Tata Kuvudundu for planting the snake in our chicken house, which he was known to have done since Nelson pointed out the footprints to many witnesses. Kilanga had fallen on trouble of every kind. The pro-Lumumbists among Anatole's schoolboys were having armed skirmishes with what was left of the National Army, now Mobutu's army, farther south along the river. We were warned that travel anywhere would be difficult. It was harder than that. Even though the rain had stopped, we could barely walk as far as the Kwenge. From there, we planned to travel by ferry all the way to Stanleyville, where Lumumba still has enormous popular support. There was work to be done, and Anatole felt we could be safe there. The money Tata Bwanda brought us was our salvation. It was a small amount, but in hard Belgian francs. Congolese currency had become useless overnight. With a million pink Congolese bills, we couldn't have bought our way onto the ferry. Everything was like that. The ground shifted while we slept, and we woke up each day to terrible new surprises. In Stanleyville, we quickly saw I was a liability even more than in Bulungu. People were outraged by the sight of white skin for reasons I had the sense to understand. They'd lost their hero to a bargain between the foreigners and Mobutu. Anatole wrapped me up in wax print panniers, hoping to disguise me as a Congolese matron while trying to keep me from staggering dazed in front of automobiles. I nearly swooned in the mill and flow of Stanleyville. People, cars, animals in the street, the austere gaze of windows in the tall concrete buildings. I hadn't stepped out of the jungle since my trip with Father to Leopoldville, a year ago or 100, I couldn't say. Anatole lost no time arranging to get us out of the city. In the back of a friend's truck covered with manioc leaves, we left Stanleyville late at night and crossed over into the Central African Republic near Bangassou. I was delivered to this mission deep in the jungle, where, amidst the careful neutrality of the sisters, a rumpled novice named Sir Liselin might pass a few months unnoticed. Without asking a single question, the Mother Superior invited Anatole and me to spend our last night together in my little blank room. My gratitude for her kindness has carried me a long way on a difficult road. Thérèse leans close and looks up at me, her eyebrows tilting like the accents above her name. Liselin, of what do you accuse yourself? Has he touched you everywhere? We expected to be parted for no more than 6 or 8 weeks while Anatole worked with the Lumumbists to reassemble their fallen leader's plan for peace and prosperity. We were that naive. Anatole was detained by Mobutu's police before he even made it back to Stanleyville. My beloved was interrogated to the tune of a broken rib, taken to Leopoldville and imprisoned in the rat-infested courtyard of what was once a luxurious embassy. Our extended separation has so far improved my devotion to Anatole, my French grammar, and my ability to live with uncertainty. Finally, I've confided to Thérèse, I understand the subjunctive tense. I shudder to think what Father would say to me here, skulking among a tribe of papist females. I pass the days as productively as I can, trying to stay clean, sharpen my aim, and keep my lip buttoned from vespers till breakfast, trying to learn the trick of what passes for patience. Every few weeks I get a letter from Leopoldville, which holds me on track. My heart races when I see the long blue envelope in a sister's hand, delivered to me under her sleeve as if a man himself were inside, and oh, he is. Still sweet and bitter and wise and best of all, still alive. I squeal, I can't help it, and run outside to the courtyard to taste him in private like a cat with a stolen pullet. I lean my face against the cool wall and kiss its old stones in praise of captivity, because it's only my being here and his being in prison that saves us both for another chance at each other. I know he despises being useless, sitting still while war overtakes us, but if Anatole were free to do as he pleased right now, I know he'd be killed in the process. If captivity is damaging his spirit, I just hope for an intact body, and will do what I can for the rest later on. The nuns spied me out there and told me I'm going to wear away their foundation. They are used to gunfire and leprosy, but not true love. Clearly, I'm here to stay a while, so Mother Marie-Pierre has put me to work in the clinic. If I can't quite get the hang of poverty, chastity, and obedience, I can learn instead about vermifuges, breech deliveries, arrow wounds, gangrene, and elephantiasis. Nearly all the patients are younger than me. Preventatives for old age are rampant here. Our supplies come from the French Catholic Relief and sometimes just thin air. Once a messenger on a bicycle came teetering up the jungle path bringing us 12 vials of antivenin, individually wrapped in tissue inside a woman's jewelry box, an astounding treasure whose history we couldn't guess. The boy said it came from a doctor in Stanleyville who was being evacuated. I thought of the Belgian doctor who'd set Ruth May's arm, and I decided to believe Ruth May herself was somehow involved in this gift. The sisters merely praised the Lord and proceeded to save a dozen people from snakebite, more than we've lost. From talking with the patients, I've gotten passably fluent in Lingala, which is spoken throughout northern Congo, in Leopoldville, and along most of the navigable rivers. If Anatole ever comes back for me, I'll be ready to go most anywhere. But then a month will pass with no letter, and I'm sure he slipped into death or recovered his clear ideals and the sense to steer clear of a badly misplaced white girl. He's gone forever. As lost to me as my sister, O sweet Jesus, Ruth May, and Ada, Rachel, mother, and father, all gone as well. What's the meaning of my still being here without name or passport, parroting how do you do in Lingala? I am trying to get some kind of explanation from God, but none is forthcoming. At nights in the refectory, we sit with our hands in our laps and stare at the radio, our small, harsh master. We hear one awful piece of news after another, with no power to act. The free Congo that so nearly came to pass is now going down. What can I do but throw my rosary against the wall of my cell and swear violence? The nuns are so patient. They've spent decades here prolonging the brief lives of the undernourished, accustomed completely to the tragedy playing out around us. But their unblinking eyes, framed by their white starched wimples, make me want to scream, "This is not God's will be done." How could anyone, even a God distracted by many other concerns, allow this to happen? "Ce n'est pas à nous," says Thérèse, "not ours to question." As convincing as Methuselah shouting, "Sister, God is great, shut the door." "I've heard that before," I tell her. "I'm sure the Congolese heard it every day for 100 years while they had to forbear the Belgians. Now they finally get a fighting chance, and we're sitting here watching it get born dead. Like that baby born blue out of that woman with tetanus this morning." That is an awful comparison, but it's true. She sighs and repeats what she's told me already. The sisters take no position in war, but must try to hold charity in their hearts, even for the enemy. But who is the enemy? Just tell me that much, Thérèse. Which side are you trying not to hate, white men or Africa? She snaps a sheet open wide in her hands and takes the center with her teeth to fold it in half, also, I think, to stop up her mouth. "I'd fight alongside the Simbas if they'd let me," I confessed to her once. Thérèse has a way of looking at me sideways, and I wonder if she wasn't too hasty in taking her vows. She's attracted to mind-sweeping. "You have a good aim and good nerve," she allowed behind the sheet she was folding. "Go join them." "You think I'm joking?" She stopped to look at me seriously. "Non, ce n'est pas une blague. But it's not your place to fight with the Simbas, even if you were a man. You're white. This is their war, and whatever happens will happen." "It's no more their war than it is God's will be done. It's the doing of the damned Belgians and Americans." The Reverend Mother would wash your mouth with disinfectant. The Reverend Mother has more pressing needs for her disinfectant. And nowhere near enough either, I thought. In the privacy of my little room, I've damned many men to hell, President Eisenhower, King Leopold, and my own father included. I damn them for throwing me into a war in which white skin comes down on the wrong side, pure and simple. If God is really taking a hand in things, I informed Thérèse, he is bitterly mocking the hope of brotherly love. He is making sure that color will matter forever. With no more to say between a devout farm girl and a minesweeper, we folded our sheets and our different colored habits. The Simbas would shoot me on sight, it's true. They're an army of pure desperation and hate. Young Stanleyville boys and old village men, anyone who can find a gun or a machete, all banded together. They tighten kisses of leaves around their wrists and declare themselves impermeable to bullets, immune to death. And so they are, Anatole says, for how can you kill what is already dead? We've heard how they sharpened their teeth and stormed the invaders in northeastern Congo, feeding on nothing but rage. 30 whites killed in Stanley, 2 Americans among them. We heard that over the shortwave radio and knew what it meant. By nightfall, the United Nations would launch their answer, an air and land attack. The combined forces they're calling this invading army, the U.S., Belgium, and hired soldiers left over from the Bay of Pigs. Over the next weeks, we heard 100 more times about the whites killed by Simbas in Stanleyville, in 3 languages, Radio France, the BBC, and Mobutu's Lingala newscasts from Leopoldville. The news was all one. Those 30 white people, rest their souls, have purchased an all-out invasion against the pro-independence. How many Congolese were killed by the Belgians and labor and starvation, by the special police and now by the UN soldiers, we will never know. They'll go uncounted, or count for nothing, if that's possible. The night the helicopters came in, the vibrations pummeled us out of our beds. I thought the old stone convent was falling down. We ran outside with the wind from the blades tearing down on us from just above the trees, whipping our plain white nightgowns into a froth. The sisters registered their dismay, crossed themselves, and hurried back to bed. I couldn't. I sat on the ground, hugging my knees, and started to cry for the first time since time began, it seems. Crying with my mouth open, howling for Ruth May and the useless waste of our mistakes and all that's going to happen now, everyone already dead and not yet dead, known or unknown to me, every Congolese child with no hope. I felt myself falling apart, that by morning I might be just bones melting into the moldy soil of the sisters' vegetable garden. A pile of eggless, unmothering bones, nothing more, the future I once foretold. To hold myself together, I tried to cry for something more manageable. I settled on Anatole. Kneeling before our little statue of the Virgin with an eroded face, I endeavored to pray for my future husband, for a chance, for happiness and love, and if you can't pray for sex outright, the possibility of children. I found I could hardly remember Anatole's face and couldn't picture God at all. He just ended up looking like my father. I tried to imagine Jesus then in the body of Brother Fowles. Tata Bidi Bidi, with his kind, pretty wife and their precarious boat dispensing milk powder and quinine and love to children along the river. Attend to creation, was his advice. Well, the palm trees in our courtyard were ripped and flattened from the wind of the helicopters and looked far too defeated by war to accept my prayers. So I focused on the sturdy walls of the compound and prayed straight to the black stones. I implored them, please let there be sturdy walls like these around Anatole. Please let them hold up a roof that will keep this awful sky from falling on him. I prayed to old black African stones unearthed from the old dark ground that has been here all along, one solid thing to believe in. Rachel Axelrod, Johannesburg, 1964. If I'd known what marriage was going to be like, well, heck, I probably would have tied all those hope chest linens together into a rope and hung myself from a tree. It isn't living here in South Africa that I mind. It hardly even seems like a foreign country here. You can get absolutely anything you need in the stores. Breck Special Formulated Shampoo, Phillips Milk Magnesia, Campbell's Tomato Soup. Honestly, you name it. And the scenery is beautiful, especially taking the train down to the beach. My girlfriends and I love to pack up a picnic basket with champagne and Tobler biscuits, which actually are cookies, not biscuits. Imagine my surprise when I bought some aiming to serve them with gravy. And then we just head out to the countryside for a view of the green rolling hills. Of course, you have to look the other way when the train goes by the townships because those people don't have any perspective of what good scenery is, that's for sure. They will make their houses out of a piece of rusted tin or the side of a crate and leave the rotten part on the outside for all to see. But you just have to try and understand they don't have the same ethics as us. That is one part of living here, be an understanding of the differences. Otherwise, this country is much like you'd find anywhere. Even the weather is very typical. I've always felt that people in other countries just don't have any idea that Africa could be this normal. The only bad thing is that with the equator being above us, the change of seasons comes backwards, which does take some getting used to. But do I complain? Heck no. I just slap up our Christmas tree in the middle of summer and sing Deck the Halls and have a martini on the patio and don't give it another thought anymore. I'm a very adaptable kind of person. I don't even mind speaking Afrikaans to the maid, which is practically the same thing as English once you get the hang of it, as long as you're just given orders anyway, which are more or less about the same in any language. And if you hear the word noose on the radio, for example, why, any fool can figure out that means news. So you just get up and switch over to the English station. I have a good life as far as the overall surroundings. I have put the past behind me and don't even think about it. Do I have a family? I sometimes have to stop and ask myself. Do I have a mother, father, and sisters? Did I even come from anywhere? Because it doesn't seem like it. It seems like I'm just right here and always was. I have a little tiny picture of my sisters and me cut out in a heart shape, which I happened to be wearing in a gold locket when I left our unfortunate circumstances in the Congo. Sometimes I get it out and stare at those teeny little sad white faces trying to make out where I am in that picture. That's the only time I ever think about Ruth May being dead. Which I've said was all because of Leah, but really, mainly, it's probably Father's fault because the rest of us just had to go along with whatever he said. If it was up to me, I would never have stepped foot in that snake-infected place. I would have sat home and let other people go be missionaries if they wanted to, bully for them. But the picture is so small I have to hold it practically at the end of my nose to make out who's who. It hurts my eyes to focus on it, so mostly it stays in the drawer. Like I said, I'm content with my present circumstances for the most part. My misery comes from a different concern, my marriage. There is just no word bad enough for Eben Axelrod, who has still not made an honest woman out of me, I might add. He just treats me like his slave girlfriend housemaid having a roll in the hay when he feels like it and then running off doing God knows what for months at a time, leaving me alone in my prime of life. But if I threaten to leave him, he calls me the poor little rich girl, which if we actually were rich would be a whole different story, and says I can't leave him because no man we know around here could afford the upkeep. That is completely unfair. Everyone we know has a nicer house than us. He received a large sum for his service in the Congo, a decent nest egg, you might say, but have I seen it? No, sir, and believe you me, I looked under the mattress, because that is the kind of person he is. Actually, there's a gun under there. He says he invested the money. He claims he's gotten back involved with the diamond business in the Congo and has many foreign partners, but you still have to remind him to take a bath on any given day. So if he has foreign partners, I don't think they're of a very high class. I told him so, too. Well, he raised up his head from his beer bottle just long enough to have a good laugh at my expense. He said, "Baby, your intellectual capacity is out of this world." Meaning the vacuum of outer space, ha-ha, his favorite joke. He said my brain was such a blank slate he could tell me every state secret he knows and then march me straight down to the Damnestry International and not have a thing to worry about. He said the government should hire me to work for the other side. This is not lovey-dovey quarreling, mind you. He says these things and laughs in my face. Oh, I have cried till I threatened to ruin my own complexion, let me tell you. But not anymore. I have abided my time and kept my eyes open, while in the meantime telling him off good in the bathroom mirror whenever I'm all alone and he's not there, just like I used to do Father. You just wait, I tell him. I'll show you whose mind is a blank slate. And now Rachel Price is about to have her day. I have a trick up my sleeve which I haven't told a soul about, even though it's the God's honest truth and I know it. I have a good shot at the ambassador. Actually, Daniel is the first attaché, but the French are all so much of a higher class, regardless of their position. Like I said, we meet the best people through the Templetons, who have divine shindigs. Come over for drinks and a bai, meaning a barbecue, is what we always say in Johannesburg. Those parties have a very international flair, what with the Scotch whiskey, American LPs, and the embassy gossip. After that one time the Prime Minister got shot in the head, there was a big old crackdown on the blacks, which was absolutely necessary, but resulted in misunderstandings at many of the foreign embassies. The nation of France especially has gotten all high and mighty about threatening to remove their associations from South Africa. We've all been hearing for weeks now that Daniel is going to be reposted to Brazzaville. His little Frenchy wife, Robine, will never hack it. I can see that as plain as day. She's well known for just as soon firing her maids as looking at them, and as far as she's concerned, everything that lies outside the civilized boundaries of Johannesburg is darkest Africa. She and Daniel were already on the verge of a breakup, even if they didn't know it. So I saw my opportunity, you might say. "She doesn't know how lucky she is," I whispered in his ear. "I'll tell you a little secret. If it was me, I'd go with you in two shakes of a lamb's tail." This was two Saturdays ago over at the Templetons when we were slow dancing around the pool to "Big Girls Don't Cry" by the Four Seasons. I happened to remember that was the song, because just that very morning I'd found out about another one of Axelrod's little piccadillies. But I'm a big girl, so I just put my hair up, marched downtown, and bought me a brand new siren red bathing suit with a bare midriff. Keeping up the insurance is how I think of it. Like they say in the magazines, just wear a smile and a Janssen. And that is exactly what I was doing two Saturdays ago at the Templeton's party. After what all I lived through in the Congo, I cooed to Daniel, I could take Brazzaville and keep right on smiling. And guess what? That's just what I'm going to do. I might as well get started packing my bags and getting measured for a Dior gown. After what I know about that man, I can wrap him around my little finger. And what he did to me, boy, a man only does that kind of thing when he has certain feelings. I can tell you with absolute